This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hi there, podcast fans. I'm Tom Gibbs. Welcome to Telegraph Audio Football Club. We are back with you with another round of the podcast that defines the best and worst ever footballing things. The categories we've got up for discussion today are fullbacks, close-range goals, boots, and films. What has everyone chosen? Let's find out. Let's take you now into a series of remote audio recording facilities where I'm joined first up by Mina Rizuki. How are you, Mina?
Hi, I'm good.
What's been happening in the last couple of weeks for you?
Well, usually I've been enjoying the sun. I got a bit of a tan. Been watching a lot of sort of old school football. And usually I've had my entourage of Disney birds outside my window, but they've left these last few days.
Oh no! What have you done to upset them?
I don't know. 5G masts.
The voice you can hear there is the voice of JJ Ball, conspiracy theorist in chief. Are you going stir crazy, JJ?
No, I'm all right. Still having a great time. It's fine. It's okay. I can deal with it.
Good. Good. Glad
you sound
to
like
hear
one
it.
Of those people that's like, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine.
No, I really am. I played a little gig yesterday from my living room. Had some people watching that. It was decent.
All the hits.
Played all the hits, yeah.
Where can the AFC Telegraph loyalists see that gig, JJ?
I think it's still on my Instagram, which would be... I don't know what my name is on Instagram, so I can't tell you. Let me find out.
Great self-promotion, JJ. Completing our lineup today after a holiday in inverted commas, it's Matt Law. How are you, Matt?
Hello, I'm good, thank you. All well.
Suntanned, I hear.
Suntanned, yeah. Flip-flop marks on my feet, so I've been enjoying the good weather. So, excellent. Not too bad.
Glad to hear it. Right, we'll start off with our ongoing quest to name the ultimate football team of all time. I'm sure we'll pull this all together at some point for some lovely online fun.
Is this what we're doing? Are we actually going through a whole team? I didn't know that.
Well, as a loyal listener to the show, Matt, you'll realise we started with goalkeepers, we moved on to centre-backs, and now we've got full-backs. So,
Have we previously ever made it clear, though, that we're going to do the whole team and that's going to be like the team? I didn't know that, honestly.
Well, you know, I assume a certain level of intelligence from the listener, and maybe that's too optimistic. But
I must admit, I had figured this out already, but it's okay.
It should never be intelligence should never be assumed from me.
Anyway, we're going to do fullbacks today, best and worst ever fullbacks. I think we've all gone best ever, and we'll start with you, Mina. Why have you picked your best ever fullback as the person you've picked?
Okay, so if we are building a team, then I'm always one of those people who thinks that your centre backs should be Italian, but your fullbacks should be Brazilian. So I've gone for Roberto Carlos. His Brazilian teammate is probably a better all-round fullback, but Carlos is one of those types of players that brought like some joy to you, like when you watched him play with his cheeky grin and the fact that he looked like he was 5'1", you know, but he wasn't, and he had thighs that were as big as my waist, 61 centimeters, FYI, you know. But Carlos was Also, because he was a Galactico, he played in Real Madrid. You saw him like do so much on the Champions League stage. You saw him score that ridiculous free kick against France, and obviously the important one against China in the World Cup en route to 2002. He was just this guy who had these massive thighs, this ability to totally dominate the left flank, the way that he would just accelerate with such pace because of this power that he could generate from his legs. You know, the center of gravity that he had was so low. And just what he could do from a distance, it was either strike the ball with such strength that it was basically going to rip the net behind it. But most importantly, you know, like when you think of Brazilian footballers, you sort of never think of like even some really successful ones like Dunga and stuff. You don't really think of them. You think of Ronaldinho, you think of Romario or Roberto Carlos, players who just really made you smile because of like their joie de vivre, you know, their desire to just entertain on the pitch with their grins or like their, you know, their just over the top behavior. And he was the guy who sort of made the modern attacking fullback his role, right?
I really hope his epitaph reads, just a guy with big thighs.
He is just a guy with big thighs.
Where would you put him in amongst the classic era of Real's Galacticos, Mina?
Oh, he's one of the most beloved. He's always remembered. And I think that it was really hard for Marcelo to come in and try to live up to the things that Carlos could do with the outside of his left boot. I think that he's just one of those guys that will always, like Zidane, be remembered as a Galactico and one of their fondest memories.
Nail something on Roberto Carlos? Can you nail this for me, Mina? He wasn't actually that good at free kicks, was he?
No. But nobody's really good at scoring every single one.
No. It's just that he kind of got this reputation for free kicks, or he decided himself he was good at free kicks after scoring that one in Le Tournoi, wasn't it, when he bent it crazily around the wall.
Yeah.
And then from then, I don't think I ever saw him score another free kick after that. And yet he was partly known for his free kicks.
2002, for Real Madrid. I think that he
scored one every 5 years.
But the deal with Carlos' free kicks is that he would bat right at the goalkeeper, who would have to parry it because he was hit so hard, and then he'd get a second chance.
Yeah.
I think video games have a lot to do with immortalising Roberto Carlos, because he was one of the first, it's like a novelty, with power 99. So whenever he took a free kick, it was quite funny. And then all those games started to get quite good around 1998, and Carlos is one of the ones that stood out.
I just think that when you think sometimes of people who take free kicks, there's obviously the ones that do it really well, Juninho or Pirlo or whatever. But then there's ones that just shock you when there is a good one. You know what I mean? It could be one every 5 years, like you're saying. It wasn't, but you know what I mean? But they were just so ridiculously good at the time that you would stand in awe because of how hard he would strike the ball. That was, I think, his power behind the ball would generate so much energy that it was just impossible for the goalkeeper to try to control it. And that used to really astound people.
Matt, you've stayed on the same flank, the left-back position. Who have you got?
I've got Ashley Cole, who I would argue with Ashley Cole. He was part of that England era when we tried to claim this kind of golden generation, around sort of 2002 through to kind of 2010, we pretty much gave up on them. But during that whole time, I would argue that he was actually England's only world-class player. And he did actually perform really well for England, despite the fact that England as a nation were not performing really well. I mean, if you think back to some of his battles at various Euros with Ronaldo, I think Ronaldo's gone on record as saying he was one of the toughest oppositions he's ever faced, and that he could never quite properly get the better in a one-on-one of Cole. He got the better of him team-wise. And I actually think he was criminally underrated during his best years. Not at Chelsea, but at Chelsea, he was always very highly rated. But outside Chelsea and round the country, because he was disliked as a person. I thought he was criminally underrated. I thought for the time he was at his best, he was by far the best English player in the England team and by far the best English player in the Premier League at that time. Just consistency and actually performing on the highest level.
What was the genesis of that dislike for him, as you put it, Matt? Was it just that bit in the autobiography? Was that the moment when people started to turn against him?
The autobiography is interesting. The autobiography absolutely flunked. It did terribly. It was almost the end of the kind of footballer autobiography era of just a famous footballer would bring out a book and it would immediately do well. It sort of killed that. And obviously there was the famous line of, you know, Arsenal were only offering me 50 grand a week, which at the time sounded like huge money, and I almost crashed my car because it was too low. And people took against of that. But if you read back that autobiography, it's worth a read back that autobiography. It's Nostradamus-like in how he foresaw what was coming at Arsenal. He completely foresaw them slipping away and not spending enough money and reeling it all back in and losing their competitiveness. Everything he talks about in that book in terms of where Arsenal were heading and why he decided he needed to leave actually came true. And I look back on all that with quite a lot of sympathy with him. I mean, he got battered at the time for leaving Arsenal for Chelsea and got accused of being greedy and accused of being this and that. But he went to Chelsea and won everything.
Yeah.
And he became a much better player as well at Chelsea. And it's a bit like, it is a little bit like when Raheem Sterling left Liverpool for Manchester City and the accusations then were made at the time. And yet, of course, he's gone on to not win everything yet, but win a lot. And there was a sense of, you know, a young black lad from Bow who wants to be paid at the top end, who wants to enjoy life and he wants to go out and win everything. There was definitely a resentment held against that.
Yeah, you definitely get the sense that both of those players were lightning rods for what people perceived to be greed and didn't like very much about those clubs with lots of money. Let's switch to the right flank now, Dave.
Can we call him Dave from now on?
Yeah. Let's do that.
Let's switch to the right flank now, JJ. Who have you got in that position?
Dave here. Right, I've got Dani Alves. Dani Alves is another one of these players that... if he'd been, you know, famous in the 90s or something like that, he'd be revered as this all-time great. He absolutely is one of the all-time great right-backs. One of the best examples of the very modern-day attacking fullback. He's basically a winger, but he did his defensive bits when he needed to. He's got 118 caps at Brazil. He's won everything. There's various... I'm trying to check it this morning. I couldn't quite find to confirm, but a lot of people have said that he is the most decorated footballer of all time. Something like 40, I think, trophies he's won in various different clubs, Champions League, everything. He's playing for his boyhood club now back in Brazil, Sao Paulo. I don't think there's anything really to say about Dani Alves other than that he's obviously magic. It's quite odd. One thing I will add is that having seen Barcelona play a couple of times, but the cool thing was when Dani Alves would warm up, it would be with Messi, and they'd both ping the ball to each other about 50 yards around down the flank in the warm-up, and then do a series of keepy-ups, then just launch a volley to the other one who would control it as though it had been passed to him, and then do the same thing back. Really cool to watch.
Can I just say something?
Yes?
I wonder how much you rate a fullback depending on who he's passing the ball to. Like, would sort of, I don't know, Roberto Carlos be amazing if he didn't have the likes of Zidane and Ronaldo up front? Would Trent Alexander, and obviously have the ability to be passing to a ridiculous front three at Liverpool?
Gary Neville and David Beckham.
Yeah, and when you think of Dani Alves, you think, would he really be that great without Messi? Does that make sense? It was almost like a telepathic understanding between them. And obviously, Dani Alves also benefited from the fact that he played in a largely horizontal team, like, and he was a vertical point within that team alongside Messi and maybe Andre and Iniesta. So that vertical edge that they had in this team made all the difference. And I wonder what you can, like, how effective is a fullback if the front guy is not that special? Does that make sense? So I wonder if their fates are tied in a way that makes Dani Alves net. Because for me, I'm not a huge fan of his, because I'll always blame our Champions League loss, Juventus in 2017 to him, because I think he made a lot of mistakes. And I do hate that. I think that sometimes he can be a little bit defensively suspect, but a lot of, you know, Carlos could be too at the time. So I'm not going to, you know.
Yeah, any attacking fullback can get caught out the back. And yeah. In that same season, you blame Dani Alves for Juventus not winning the Champions League. He scored 3 goals on the way to get into that, you know, the bit where they got knocked out. He's won titles everywhere he's been. Like, he's a proven winner. And I kind of like the story. He comes from, he grew up on a farm with like a dirt pitch we used to play football on. He used to have to get up early, I think it was like 4 or 5 a.m. in the morning with his brother and do work on the farm. And they'd have to work the hardest, as determined by their father, because whoever worked the hardest got to have access to their only bicycle to then do the 12-mile journey to school and then back. So whoever won got the bicycle, whoever didn't, he had to walk. So Dani Alves used to run, which helps explain his incredible engine and stamina and ability to run up and down that flank all day long, because he was doing it as a kid when he was getting up and down the flank. Yeah, he was decent at Sevilla as well, remember? Not good enough to go play for Barcelona, the best team I've ever seen play was that Barcelona team. Then he went and won the league at Juventus, Paris Saint-Germain. He's doing pretty well at Sao Paulo now. And he's been a mainstay at the Brazil squad forever.
Yeah, but Maxwell also won with PSG. There are just some teams that will always win.
Yeah, but then you don't always have to be the best player to be hugely important to the team. And you could argue the same thing with Puyol. Maybe Puyol wasn't playing next to Messi and Xavi, he wouldn't be the amazing creature that he was.
Absolutely.
All the component parts form the team. And it's so much easier to look back on Cafu as being this amazing player. But Cafu didn't win anything near as much as Dani Alves won.
Because, again, he was playing for Roma, right? You know? Okay,
well,
Tom.
Yes, well, we have slightly spoiled my pick, which is Cafu. I think you're a little bit harsh saying he hadn't won nearly as much as Alves. I mean, that is true, but a pretty good career to be the most capped Brazilian of all time. Man of the match in the 1994 World Cup final. Recovered from the disappointment of 1998 to win again in 2002. He's the only player to ever appear in 3 consecutive World Cup finals. And there was just such an elegance to Cafu. So, and it's kind of an elegant career as well. I think you think of a lot of Brazilians and they end up playing for sort of half a dozen clubs in South America and then come over and just rattle around the European leagues for many years. But he only played for 5 clubs, really. Long spells at Roma and AC Milan. And I especially like the fact that he was nicknamed the Pendolino after the tilting train, which is always good to be named after a train or any mode of transport, really. I'm into it. Let's move on to the second category today, which is close range goals. And you've picked your best ever, Matt. Please state your winner for the category.
Well, I struggled with this a bit because, in all honesty, I don't really have a favourite close range goal. My week off the other week coincided with my birthday. I was reminded that of one of my favourite ever games of Villa Birmingham, which was a few days before my birthday one year, when Gary Cahill scored an absolutely incredible overhead kick for Villa in a game we won 3-1 from within the 6-yard box. It was close range, but for a central defender, it looked like something Cristiano Ronaldo might do, the way he got up off the ground for it. And it kind of brought it all back, that feeling from that day. So that was probably that. And it also, I mean, I get a lot of Mickey taken out of me for this, but it kind of helped launch the career of Gary Cahill, who I've been a great fan of ever since. And unfortunately, Villa let him go to sign Zach Knight, which has got to be one of the worst decisions by Martin O'Neill ever, to sell Gary Cahill to Bolton to fund a move to sign Zach Knight from Fulham.
Was there outcry at the time among Villa fans?
No, there wasn't. I mean, incredibly, there wasn't. I mean, Cahill was thought of as a decent young player at Villa, but really no more than that. He wasn't seen as this real talent that we had. And unfortunately, it's kind of Bolton who gave him the platform to do that. I mean, he did play 23 times for us in the Premier League, but mainly as subs and in games where other people weren't available. I mean, he was around when Villa had quite a good side. But yeah, I mean, the fact we let him go is just a killer, because the career he went on to have. And I think when we talked about this over email, you pointed out he also has had quite a good goal-scoring career for a central defender, although not scored in any of the last three seasons.
Mm. He did score a screamer against QPR on the opening day of the season with Bolton in 2011. What was he doing up in that position, Matt? You look back at that and he was sort of goal-hanging almost. Was it in the aftermath of a corner or something like that?
It was in the aftermath of a set piece, but I think probably what it shows you and why he scored 44 goals in his career, which is pretty decent for a centre-back, is that it was in like the second, third or fourth phase of play that he ended up putting the ball in the net. And whereas most defenders would go up for the original set piece and once the ball's been bobbling around a bit, start trotting back, he held his position. He was there in the six-yard box waiting for a chance. And we were 2-1 up at the time, so it's not like we were after a last gasp goal and he'd been thrown forward. But he did take it like a striker. I mean, it was an incredible finish.
Yeah, it's a quite outrageous moment from Matt Law's favourite ever player. JJ, who have you got? JJ, you're continuing your Barcelona theme here. Who have you got?
I wasn't sure how to interpret this question in the best all-time close goal, because what does it mean? Because all of Messi's goals where he dribbles past seven people are technically close when he finishes, but they're solo efforts. So anyway, I went for that Sergio Roberto goal against PSG in the Champions League, as Barca, it was a 6-1 comeback. Obviously, it is more for the occasion and the entire match rather than the actual goal. It's a great ball over the top by Neymar for Roberto to hook in, but it's one of those moments where I was live blogging it. I remember, and everyone in the office that was there at the time, there's just noise, there's pandemonium in this little quiet office. Well, it's quite big actually. But yeah, that was one of my favourite moments in football was that. And when I was trying to think of a close-range goal, I can think of things like it's the associated noise with it, the feeling you get. Like, for example, Robbie Fowler's headed winner against Newcastle in a 4-3 win, the second 4-3 back in 97, I think it was. The noise from the crowd is something that I always can remember because having watched that as highlights. But yeah, the Sergio Roberto thing was incredible.
Can I just add one, just before Mina adds a proper one? I don't know why that reminded me of this at all. It's obviously something JJ said because it's not related. But one of the greatest close-range goals has also got to be David Nugent for England.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that? 2007, yeah. Jermaine Defoe has basically scored. The ball's rolling over the line, and on the line, Nugent just cushions it in and in his interviews takes the goal and everything. Well, it wouldn't go down well these days, I don't think. That caused
no.
it now.
Gerrard again. There's no offside. Defoe! And on the line was Nugent. They'll have to sort that one out between them. Well, in the record books, it'll go down as David Nugent's, I think. And that's a striker.
But he'll always be an England goal scorer, just like Zach Knight will always have two England caps, as I learned while you were talking about him. Matt, I suppose one of the other ones you could talk about for occasions is Solskjaer's for United, for that kind of drama. But anyway, the one I've got is very much not about the occasion, because it was a World Cup qualifier for England in 1997 at the old Wembley. Alan Shearer got an indirect free kick from the very corner of the six-yard box against the Georgians. There were about between 10 or 11 of their team were on the line trying to defend it, and it was teed up for him and he hit it, and we've said this before about Alan Shearer, incredibly hard into the roof of the net. It was so satisfying to see that, because you often see those very close range indirect free kicks never ever come to anything, but that was a moment where it was just executed to perfection. Good old Alan Shearer. Who have you got, Mina?
This goal is actually my favourite goal probably ever, or at least in my top five, definitely in my top five memories, and it's kind of the goal that I don't know, like, okay, so obviously I'm a girl and I was like sort of on the fence about Juventus, because I realized I started supporting them and I didn't like the fact that I was supporting them, but there were just so many nice things about them.
Why didn't you like the fact you were supporting them?
Because I thought at the time, because we had this thing, like my mother's a little bit crazy in the household. So every time the World Cup would come, we weren't allowed to support any team that had a high annual GDP. Like, okay. Like, as in, if Uruguay was playing, then we'd have to support the other team. Does that make sense? Because Uruguay had such a hot, you know, they were rich, basically, you know. And I was really, really liked Uruguay in the Copa America, for example. Okay. So we were always had to support, like, the team that no one had heard of or the team that probably has poverty. And she'd get really upset if she thought that you were, like, on the side of Germany or something. Do you know what I mean? Juventus is obviously the richest team in Italy. Like, you know, they were owned by the Agnellis, and I just thought she was just always going to be really disappointed that I went for a capitalist choice. So it was kind of that kind of thing. But there was just so much about Juve, like from Gaetano Scirea, my choice for centre back. You know, such a good guy. The fact that they were owned by the Agnellis. The fact that, like, Agnelli was supposedly having an affair once upon a time with JFK's woman. It was like this Hollywood team. And then they won 96. It was like, yeah, blah, blah, Champions League. Not that interesting. But 97 was super interesting for me. I thought it was, like, an astonishingly good final. It was Borussia Dortmund. And they were, like, 2-0 ahead. And there was just this kid, obviously, now a kid, I mean, he was 22, 23. Now he's like close to retirement age at this time and age. But back then he was a kid, when that's how you referred to him. And he just came onto the scene and he was like the second top goal scorer in 96. And he was just this ridiculous talent. And you thought Italy's got their next, you know, Baggio for the next 20 years. He was amazing. He was, you know, Del Piero had this ability, this talent, this touch, this technique, this everything you wanted in a football player. And then 97 Champions League final, and he gets, he's been injured, comes on at halftime, and there's just this moment where Boxic cuts the ball back to him. It's like a low cross, and Del Piero just ends up with backheels it into the goal with a flick and gets one back for Juve. And you think Juve have a chance, but it was the most amazing finish from a guy that just looked like at the time that nothing would faze him. He had such sheer confidence in himself that honestly, I never saw a lot of that because of his injury. But back then, you felt like he owned the world and he was totally okay with it. And I don't know, that goal like just changed everything. And I know that they lost, but I just realized I was a fan.
And it had a very big effect on your digital life as well, Mina.
Yeah, after that, I changed my name on so I opened an email account and my name became Mina Del Piero. Well into my university, actually.
Gol fantastico di Del Piero! Una magia proprio lui al diciottesimo, 2-1.
Fantastico gol di Del Piero, però è stato anche bravo Boxic a tenere viva quella palla.
Right, JJ, it's time for topic three. And that topic is boots. And you've nominated your best ever boots. Describe them if any listeners have not seen the name of boots you're about to tell us.
The Adidas Copa Mundial. They are the classic black leather with white stripe. Just the three Adidas stripe. They've got the nice black studs at the bottom, the little small ones. They're the ones that every single coach wears. So you'll notice if you look in the sidelines at any game, all the coaching staff are wearing Copa Mundials. They are the comfiest. They feel like slippers. Have you ever had a pair? Oh, they're nice. So that's one of the best things. But they're also worn by lots of very famous players like Beckenbauer, Zidane, David Beckham, Jari Litmanen. Maradona wore them as well. They're made for the 82 World Cup, apparently. And they have remained a classic ever since.
Have you ever owned a pair?
Have I? They're my favourite boots I've ever had. Yeah, they're expensive. They cost about £100 and something normally, which seems like a lot, especially when you're not very good at football. But they they last ages. But it's how they feel, and because they look cool, they make you a better footballer.
Yes, that's almost definitely true. I've got a nomination for the worst ever boots, which were the first pair of boots I ever owned, which were made by a brand called Quasar. And they were kind of neon orange. Well, they weren't neon orange. They were predominantly black because it was the early 90s, but they had a little neon orange accent. They were endorsed by Gary Lineker, these boots, but he definitely wasn't wearing the pair that I wore because I think my mum got them fairly cheaply. And after my first game in them, I had blisters, like just the entire size of the back of the boots, all over the back of my heel. And, you know, I think it set me back as a footballer. I think I could have had a wonderful career if only my mum had shelled out hundreds of pounds on a pair of Copa Mundials for me. What have you got, Mina?
Can I just say that, like, when you sent, when our producer, Joel, sent over the questions and it said boots, and then Matt decided to reply to all of them and just went, black boots? That was like my favourite moment.
Doesn't need to be football boots either. It's just black. I've got a thing about black boots. Doesn't need to be football boots.
Oh, okay. I thought like you were just like so like.
No, I'm joking. No, I'm joking.
So I was trying to think of like the worst boots, and I have a thing against people who wear brown shoes. I don't know why. I hate the colour brown when it comes to footwear. Tolerated on women, absolutely despised on a man. And there was just always one thing that my dad used to say, which is, you know, like the first thing you need to look at is make sure what color his shirt is. Like if he's one of those ridiculous people, or, you know, and if he wears brown shoes, he's out, you know. And I think it's obviously because my dad was a banker and that was at the time in the city unacceptable to wear brown shoes. And I still sort of carry that with me now. I don't know why. There's a part of me that's always like really not very into like these brown suit shoes. And in 2009, Adidas... or Adidas, however you say it, released these brown, like, Adipure boots, and they were just the ugliest thing that you'll ever see. Like, it was honestly, like, they're just gross. If you ever have a chance to look them up, it just looks like you're wearing, like, turd. I don't know how to explain it. but it's like, they anyway. But they were sported by Jimmy Bullard in 2009, so he made them somewhat tolerable to... Well, no, they still were disgusting. But if you do have a chance to look at them, please, it just looks like you just stepped in a bit of dog poo and that's what your shoes look like.
Crikey. Matt, have you had some time to think about this now? Have you got any further along with your thinking or are you sticking with just black boots?
Well, I'll explain that because when I was a kid, Puma King were the boots around where I was that all the best players had. I never had Puma Kings. But Puma, you had to be a properly good player around where I was growing up and playing a bit of kids football to own a pair of Puma Kings. And you always spotted, you know, the oppo, if there was someone in their team with Puma Kings, you knew they were going to be good, and they generally were. So they were like the boot everybody wanted and that I would have kind of given a left whatever for at the time. But as I've grown older, I don't really care about boots. All I care about is they don't look stupid now. So I'm very much a black boot man. And I'll take this back. When Harry Winks made his England debut, I think it was against either Lithuania or Ukraine. I can't remember which. I was there. And he wore a pair of just completely all black boots. And I think I remember writing a whole 150-word article for the newspaper that night on just basically how brilliant Harry Winks was on the basis of the fact, I loved the fact he was just wearing plain black boots. I was a bit disappointed after the game to find out when I interviewed him, and I was all ready to kind of hail him and have him down as this working class hero and isn't this fantastic. And then actually I just found out the only reason he was wearing all black boots was because he was in some sort of debate with his boot sponsor and trying to move. So he'd blacked them out to not give them any coverage because he was trying to negotiate a massive deal for some stupid pink and yellow boots that were about to come.
You haven't mentioned Predators. Like the 97-98 era Predators, well, with the little red flash. My God, they were beautiful.
Were the Predators, as well, am I remembering it correctly as well, that the Predators are the one with the funny sort of design on the
ridges,
on the
yeah.
front of the boat, the ridges, yeah, which caused a lot of controversy at the time.
The thing that tickled me about the Predators was that the very first pair of them, which didn't have the red on it, they were all black, they had the ridges at the front, but they also had the ridges on the back. What were they supposed to be, like swerving your back heels? I just don't see what the point was of that. Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Makes you run faster, it's like a stripe in a car.
Ha ha ha.
Go beyond the headlines with The Telegraph's daily coronavirus podcast, a roundup of the latest news on the pandemic from our leading journalists, with analysis on the impact on health, business and travel every weekday evening. Search Coronavirus The Latest on your podcast app.
Let's finish off with the final category today, which is football film. Different to football documentary, works of fiction here. And I want to nominate one that I think could be either the best or the worst ever. I think it's probably the worst ever, but it's eligible for both, I think. And that's The Football Factory, the Danny Dyer film, which came off the John King book, which actually is a slightly better book than you might expect if you've only seen the film. But I kind of know this film is awful, but it's one of those that if I'm ever channel flicking and it's on, I will have to watch it all the way through. And I think, I mean, it's pretty low rent, let's be honest. There's a lot of quite gratuitous violence. There's certainly a lot of gratuitous swearing, a lot of comedy cockney nonsense. But there's just, let's face it, Danny Dyer, he's a very compelling actor, isn't he? He's a wonderful, there's just something about him that makes him very, very watchable. So I will always watch The Football Factory. Bit of a guilty pleasure, but there we go.
There's a better version of that film. Have you seen ID? That's actually quite good.
I haven't seen ID. I should watch ID.
You should.
It's a good man.
It's actually really good. It's terribly violent and terribly indulgent in kind of faux Cockney hooliganism, but it's actually a really good film. And I think it's probably what The Football Factory should have been.
Yes, certainly both a lot better than Green Street, which is absolutely dreadful. You've also got a worst nomination, Mina. What is it?
Mine is actually like, this was kind of hard because I was trying to think of like football films that I thought were rubbish or ones that were really good. And I can actually think of one, but Ronaldo is the most disappointed I've watched in, you know, the movie on him. It was the most disappointed I've ever been in watching something to do with football because I just felt like I wasted 2 hours of my life in what was nothing more than a vanity project. Let me just put it out there. I'm a huge Ronaldo fan. Obviously, he plays for my team. I've always been like really on board with the fact that I'm one of those people who, while acknowledging I think Messi's a better player, I love sort of like the philosophy behind Ronaldo, which is that anyone can work the hardest to reach to the top if they really want something. But I just felt like when you do great movies on people, biographical movies, like the ones that are like Senna are always going to be the best. But this was just almost like him just showing you how great he is. It doesn't really delve deep into the vulnerabilities that make these things really interesting to watch. And it's like you want drama. You don't want him to say, it kind of just came across as like one of those weird interviews, like in an office that when you're trying to get a job and someone says to you, okay, so what do you do badly? And you're like, oh, well, I have this terrible thing where I'm like such a good team player that I don't really like, you know, think of myself often and that can stop me from progressing. You know, one of those things where your weakness ends up being like this massive thing that's brilliant about you as well. And I just felt like anything that was shown in that like film about him to be a weakness wasn't really a weakness. And he's much nicer guy. He's much sweeter, much more shy, kind of really obsessed with the way he looks at him and the world looks at him. And you get that from his everyday lifestyle and his interviews. But you just didn't get that from the movie. And the movie just ended up, I hated him. I was like, oh my God, you just came across as just this guy who spends lots of money, who thinks he's, you know, the ultimate player. And it's a shame.
It's weird that it's rubbish. I haven't watched it, but it's weird that it's rubbish because the guy who directed it, I mean, you said Senna there. I didn't realise it's the same director as Senna, which is an amazing film. And the Amy Winehouse one, which is an amazing film as well.
So you it's would imagine weird.
He would come up with something pretty good.
But it almost looked like he was, it almost like the director looked like he was like, had his teammates held hostage and was like, you have to say this about him and you have to say that about him. And, you know, like, he trains like an animal. And I don't know, just none of it seemed to be quite genuine. Like the whole thing. And you just see Jorge Mendes come across as a sycophant. You sort of know that, you know, he's not exactly an agent that's ever going to be realistic about things. But like, the whole thing just looked like a weird vanity project. I was so disappointed because it's like you said, it was created by some of the best, you know?
Yeah, I suppose the thing you would say about that is that he was the exec producer of Ronaldo rather than a director, which he did for Senna and the Maradona film, which was absolutely amazing. I'm surprised, Mina, you were surprised that it was a vanity project. I mean, surely you hear Cristiano Ronaldo documentary and think that is the definition of a vanity project.
This is what I mean. Like, that's what the idea is of Ronaldo. So why not create a documentary that or a film that changes people's minds? Instead, you just reinforce that. So it's like, what's the point? Why are you making the world hate you? Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're going to do something like this and you're Ronaldo and everyone thinks of you as being the most arrogant thing in the world, then obviously your film should be one that changes minds. That's what I didn't understand, you know? It's like when you watch, like, there's a documentary on Benzema. There's one on Kroos as well right now that's really good. And in that, you, like, learn so much about them. And you're like, oh, wow, I had no idea. Like, Benzema dealt with so much racism and he's really had to work hard for his role. And you have this newfound appreciation for him. With Kroos, it was, like, the way that he was treated by some people. And again, you're like, oh, my God, wow, you know. You just didn't get that with Ronaldo. You're like, yep, that's the guy I thought he was, you know.
What have you got, Matt, for this category?
Mine is The Damned United, about Brian Clough's 44 days in charge of Leeds United, which is also a wonderful book. Full disclosure, I sort of picked this because it's currently on BBC iPlayer and it meant I could watch it yesterday and tell my family it was for work.
Yes, and good thinking.
I got left alone for an hour and a half to just watch that, which was a nice indulgent pleasure. But it is genuinely, genuinely a brilliant film. I mean, the story itself is just incredible, which I'm not going to have to go through now, but I could watch and read everything about Clough, but that 44 days in terms of what happened at Leeds and the build-up to it is just an incredible story. But it's actually brilliantly acted as well. Martin Sheen does a superb Clough. And I reminded myself of this yesterday, because at the end of the film is the scene where after Clough gets sacked by Leeds, he that night goes straight onto Yorkshire Television and does an interview alongside Don Revie, which is one of the great football interviews, televised interviews, because it's just so incredible. And that's the final scene of the film. So I watched that and immediately went onto YouTube and watched The Real Thing. And it's just incredible. He's got him down to an absolute T. Everything about him. It's a superb, superb film. And it's also brilliant for Timothy Spall plays a great who does Timothy Spall play? I've forgotten now. We're going to have to Peter Taylor. Timothy Spall plays a brilliant Peter Taylor. The guy who plays Don Revie, who is quite a famous actor, whose name escapes me, he's also excellent. And it's just really good. And, I mean, for anyone who out there who maybe knows a lot about Clough through all his glory of Forest and Derby and has sort of heard about the Leeds stuff and has never either read this book or watched this film, I would definitely say go out and watch it immediately, because it's just as fascinating as the good stuff about Clough, that how wrong this period of his career went.
Yeah, I remember watching that and thinking, oh, he's definitely hamming it up a little bit here, Michael Sheen. But when you saw, as you say, Matt, the actual reality, he completely spoke in that way. He had an incredibly odd way of phrasing things. An incredibly charismatic man, and as you say, Sheen got him perfectly, almost as well as he got Chris Tarrant in the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire thing recently. JJ, complete the category, please, with your best ever film nomination.
I went for the hit incredible movie Goal, The Dream Begins, as it's called in the United States, which is a 2005 drama. And boy, it's a drama. Directed by Danny Cannon, who was that boy who made the really bad Judge Dredd film, The Slice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's his thing. It's a classic tale of a Mexican illegal immigrant living in Los Angeles. He's a skilled footballer from a broken home. And he gets noticed one day by Glenn Foy, who is a former Newcastle United player with a difficult Scottish accent, who takes him over to England to play for Newcastle. And it's one of those, and then he gets bullied. Actually, that's another thing that happens. He gets bullied by another guy who's really mean and breaks his inhaler, which is surely illegal or something. Anyway, it turns out that he's been hiding his asthma from the club. They then say, you can't play until you fix your asthma. And then he plays and he scores a winning goal. Sorry to spoiler alert this, it's 2005. He scores a winning goal. In fact, he sets up one where he dribbles past the entire team, and it's the best thing about this movie is it's essentially a parody of itself. Like, if you weren't aware, it was serious. You'd think it was like Airplane. And there's all these clips and scenes where the guy whose name is Santiago Muniz, played by an actor called Kuno Becker, tries to do football skills he clearly doesn't know how to do. And the camera has to cut between the footage of real players doing skills and then the boy Muniz doing like a spin. So I'd imagine they filmed it by the guy just doing a 360 on the spot, just jumping up and spinning, and then we cut to some legs, like someone from a different race running along the pitch. And then he scores a goal in the final minutes, which is a Laurent Robert free kick in real life. And the best thing about that is he runs up to take it with his right foot. Robert, of course, left-footed, just in the top corner. It's a fantastic movie that everyone should enjoy.
Yeah, you've made a very good argument there, JJ, for a really, really good film. That's all for this week. Remember, you can get in contact with me on Twitter if you'd like to. It's at Tom with an H, Gibbs. Send us your nominations for categories and your picks for best or worst ever, if you like, to afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk. We will not be shy about using your picks to power this podcast next week. Have your say about what you want to hear from us. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Look for Telegraph Audio Football Club wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Joel Grove on the buttons, and thanks to you for your company. I'll talk to you again soon.